It is 7:30, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very happy and lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, John Buchanan. He is author of the new book, Fixing America, Breaking the Stranglehold on Corporate Rule, Big Media, and the Religious Right. John, thanks for coming in this morning.
Mike, thank you for having me this morning.
Let us begin. We got a lot to cover in a half hour. Let's start out and give people kind of a brief overview of the subject matter in your book, Fixing America.
Okay. Very briefly, I try to talk about in the book the very important issues facing the country that I don't think either presidential candidate, unfortunately, has talked about in this election cycle. First is the fact that the giant transnational corporations rule this country lock, stock, and barrel. The second section of the book is about the fact that lobbyists are the instrument of subversion in this country. The third section of the book is about the reality that war profiteering has become the career of choice for Washington insiders and former government officials. The next section, which is very important and probably the most controversial section of the book, is called The Rise of Religion and Theocracy, and it details how the extreme far-right wing of the so-called evangelical Christian movement, the militarist wing of the evangelical Christian movement, has had a very detrimental effect on foreign policy, Iraq being the classic example. The next section is about the failure of the media and how the corporate control of the mass media has subverted the news and information that we need to be informed citizens. And the next section of the book, and arguably most important, is called Disappearing Civics, which is about the fact that only half of us vote and fewer than that have any true understanding of what's really going on in the country. When you add all of that up, I believe that you have a formula for disaster, whether John Curry is elected or George Bush is elected, unless we, the people, really bite the bullet and face up to what's going on in this country and have the resolve as citizens to do something about it.
All right. And tell us, how is it that you came to writing this book?
The way that I came to writing the book is that based on my work last year that had to do with the Bush family, notably the so-called Bush Nazi articles that I wrote in the New Hampshire Gazette. A few days after the first article appeared, John McConnell, the 89-year-old founder of Earth Day, called me up from Denver and asked me to run for president. I don't know how in his mind he made the great leap from the Bush Nazi articles to me running for president, but God bless him, he did. I originally told him I wasn't interested in running for president, but I would be interested in writing a platform with him for a legitimate new third party that would really represent the interest of all Americans on the key issues that I was interested in. So I started working on that platform, which ultimately became the framework for the book. But the next thing that happened was a gentleman named Bob Furtick, the CEO of Democrats.com, the large Democratic website that's the progressive alternative to the DNC, called me up on November 13th and asked me to run for president. But this time it was a tactical maneuver, and he suggested that I run as a Republican against George W. Bush in the New Hampshire primary. I moved up to New Hampshire on January 2nd, became a card-carrying Republican, and ran against Bush as the so-called truth candidate, which later became the 911 truth candidacy. I tied for second place in the New Hampshire Republican primary. I beat 12 other Republicans, and I got more Republican votes than the Democrats, Dick Gephardt, Al Sharpton, and Carol Moseley Braun combined. They spent more than $1 million on their campaigns. I spent $3,000. I'm convinced that the reason that I did as well as I did in New Hampshire is simply because the people of this country, of both parties, and liberals and conservatives, are just desperate to hear the truth. And I went out more as a journalist than as a politician, and regardless of what I was asked, I just looked the questioner in the eye and told the truth. And everyone knows that the system is broken. Everyone knows that corporations rule our lives. Everyone knows that it's a horrible disease for corporate lobbyists to make multi-million-dollar salaries. Everybody knows in their gut that the reason we're in Iraq is so that Lockheed and Raytheon and Boeing and Halliburton can make money that it has nothing to do with exporting freedom and democracy. And I think what's so critically important about this election, with everything that's at stake in this country, is that we, the people, need to face the music. If we remain in denial much longer about what we're up against in this country, whichever one of them is elected by 2008, it won't matter who's president of this country. It'll be largely over for us, I think.
All right, and back up a step further. What was it that got you to write the articles for the New Hampshire Gazette, and tell us about those articles?
Well, believe it or not, I had actually just set out to write a movie script. I lived in L.A. for 14 years before I lived in Miami Beach for 7, and I decided in the late spring of 2003 that what I really wanted to do was become a movie screenwriter and move back to Los Angeles. So I cooked up, I found the original Bush Nazi information on a website called TakeBackTheMedia.com. They had this really cool flash movie titled Bush Is Not a Nazi, So Stop Saying So. And, you know, as creativity functions, and, you know, nobody who does any writing or music or painting or whatever for a living understands how it really works, but, you know, somehow this idea popped into my head to write a movie script based on the leverage of a blackmail scheme from Germany against the Bush family for their Nazi past. I wrote the script, submitted it to an agent in Hollywood, and the good news was the agent liked the movie script, but the bad news was he said that because it was so politically charged and all of the people in it were real, you know, Bush, his father, Dick Cheney, and so on, that the only way he would have any hope of selling the script was if I actually went and proved that the Bush family had this Nazi past. That was on September 2nd of 2003. I'm very aggressive and very dogged when I want to accomplish something, and I did my homework and found out that these documents apparently were at the National Archives and Library of Congress, and I went to Washington September 17th and went to the National Archives and then to the Library of Congress and copied approximately 500 pages of documents that, you know, lay it all out. And then I ended up at war with the major media. I originally was so shocked by what I had found that I didn't even try to write the story myself. I figured I was in way over my head as a freelance journalist from Miami. So I tried to play like Daniel Ellsberg and just leak the documents or give them away. And I offered them exclusively to the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, and the three major television networks. And they wouldn't even look at the documents, much less report the story. And this information had been covered up for 70 years. It had just been expunged from the public record. It didn't exist anywhere in any way that, you know, mattered. And so, lo and behold, I ended up writing the stories myself and publishing them in the New Hampshire Gazette, which is the oldest newspaper in America, and gave Samuel Adams his first byline in 1756. Those stories, in turn, largely thanks to the internet, ran all over the world in about 80 countries and made the front page of Pravda and Haaretz in Israel and, you know, papers all over the world. But the story has never really gotten out to the extent that it should have. And if the American people really knew the extent of the criminality of the Bush family going back 100 years, I don't think that either Bush would have been elected president, frankly.
And you feel that you ran across information and conveyed it that definitely showed a smoking gun connection between the Bush family knowingly working with the Nazis in the past?
Absolutely. There were, number one, their business relationship was with the Nazi industrialist Fritz Thyssen, which was spelled T-H-Y-S-S-E-N. Fritz Thyssen was the wealthiest man in Germany. He controlled the steel and coal business, etc. And excuse me for that. He controlled the steel and coal business in Germany, and by virtue of the fact that he controlled the steel and coal industries, he physically was one of the two individuals who completely engineered and built the Nazi war machine. That is well documented. The other critical factor is that the New York Herald Tribune ran a story on July 30th of 1942 on its front page, Hitler's Angel has $3 million in U.S. Bank. The story number one said that credible sources said that he was actually sitting on money for Goebbels, Goring, other top Nazis, and perhaps even Hitler himself. The article also suggested that politically prominent American families were involved in the bank, and those families were the Harrimans, Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the current president, and George Herbert Walker, his maternal great-grandfather, for whom his father is named. I have in my possession documents that not only show that Prescott Bush was a shareholder, a stockholder in Union Banking Corporation, but a colleague of mine, a German journalist named Eva Schweitzer, earlier this year went to Columbia University and found Prescott Bush's actual diaries in his own handwriting, where he talks about his day-to-day management of this web of Thyssen-controlled Nazi front businesses. To me, the smoking gun, which is beyond refutation, is that beginning 3 weeks after the Herald Tribune story, as a direct result of the Herald Tribune story, the FDR administration began seizing all of these Nazi front businesses under the Trading with the Enemy Act. And the critical thing about that is that these seizures of these businesses that were operating as Nazi front enterprises were continuing to do so after the U.S. entered the war. And for those of your listeners who don't immediately know what that means the grandfather and great-grandfather of the President of the United States today were guilty of treason and should have been tried for treason for giving aid and comfort to our enemy in a time of war. And not only were they not tried for treason, but this information has been largely covered up for 70 years.
And to be fair, we're not saying here that the sins of the grandfather necessarily are transferred to those of the kids and the grandkids. But the thing here is that the media has not covered this.
That's absolutely correct. And, I'm actually really glad that you brought up that point, because I 100% agree that the sins of the grandfather should not ever be held against any grandson. And that was never part of my reporting, and I never suggested that in any media interview that I did. My first story was about the fact that after 70 years of inattention and even denial by the U.S. media, there was now no question that these documents existed and that this story was true. And as I said earlier, I believe that if this information and the extent of the Bush family relationship with Nazis had been known, certainly Daddy Bush would have been held accountable. The reason for that is that Prescott Bush was also involved in a major story that just came out and became public about a little over 3 weeks ago, which was that a very infamous Nazi war criminal named Reinhard Gehlen, G-E-H-L-E-N, was actually the de facto founder of the CIA, along with Alan Dulles, and that Prescott Bush was instrumental in Reinhard Gehlen and other Nazi war criminals being smuggled out of Germany into the U.S. Believe it or not, Nazis worked for the early congressional campaigns of Daddy Bush, and a former U.S. Justice Department war crimes prosecutor named John Loftus was part of an Emmy-winning 60 Minutes segment in 1982 that proved that there were Nazis working in high-ranking U.S. government jobs, and that Daddy Bush had consciously brought Nazi war criminals and their descendants into the U.S. government. And I think that certainly makes it relevant to the generation of Daddy Bush, and I don't even think that the president can directly be held accountable for the sins of his father. But I, when you look at it as a family and as a dynasty, as Kevin Phillips called the Bush family, you start to understand the sinister influence that this family has had for 100 years on this country, beginning with Samuel Bush, who was Prescott's father, who was a war profiteer in World War I. And I think when you add it all up and look at what George W. Bush has done to this country, then I think there is a relevance that ought to be part of the public debate. I consider them to be a family of war profiteers and war criminals that have never been brought to justice properly.
Yeah, I think that's a part of American history that needs a lot more focus, is things like Operation Paperclip, which brought over people like Wernher von Braun, who had developed the V-1, V-2 rockets that went into Britain, and he basically put our Apollo space program together.
That's so correct.
So you, sometime after this, you had a run-in with the Secret Service. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, run in would be a would be a polite term. As a result of doing as well as I did, just as a common citizen in the New Hampshire Republican primary, and going every night and at every opportunity, and calling the president a liar about the war in Iraq and the killer of innocent Iraqi civilians and a subverter of the Constitution, and you know all of the sound bites I was able to get out in New Hampshire. I was invited to speak at the National Press Club on Wednesday, February 4th. So I stayed up in New Hampshire. I flew down to Washington that morning with the expectation of coming back to New Hampshire for a few more days that the next morning. And when I got to Baltimore, Washington Airport at noon that day, I was taken off the flight by two U.S. Secret Service agents who claimed that they had an anonymous tip from New Hampshire that I was leading a plot to assassinate the president. I really went into shock and made a lot of mistakes. For example, they told me when they first took me into the interrogation room, which I think was an INS facility at Baltimore, Washington Airport, when I asked, they told me I had no right to a phone call and no right to an attorney because I was a national security threat. I'm 54 years old, I've been around the block, and I was very stupid in believing that I had no rights to a phone call or an attorney. And for your listeners who don't know this, what I have found out since is that even under Ashcroft and the Patriot Act, we all have rights to a phone call and an attorney. They questioned me for 2.5 hours. They let me go. I made my speech that night at the press club. The next morning, I went to Capitol Hill and called on the House Judiciary Committee Republican staff to ask for a congressional inquiry into why the Secret Service would want to talk to a pacifist who had never been in any kind of trouble in his life. Two members of the Republican staff of the Judiciary Committee promised me a congressional inquiry, never returned my phone calls, never responded to my emails again. At the end of 2 hours, they asked me what it was I wanted or what I was most concerned about. I told them that what I was most concerned about was that I had just been taken in by the Secret Service and very aggressively interrogated for 2.5 hours, and that I was afraid when I went home to Miami after being gone for 5 weeks that I would be arrested for something. They said, "Oh, you see, John, now you're a paranoid conspiracy nut. Why would anybody arrest you?" I rode the train home, got home to Miami on Friday, February 6th, and on Tuesday, February 10th, I was arrested in my apartment on a 14-count felony indictment for aggravated stalking against a victim they could never produce in court. I finally went to trial August 11th with a public defender who mysteriously lost to my case and told me I was probably going to prison. And overnight that night of August 11th and 12th, a committee to defend John Buchanan sprang up online, and they got me a lawyer, a wonderful lawyer through the National Lawyers Guild, a woman named Ray Shearn in Miami, and she got the charges against me dismissed in 5 minutes on August 16th, and I now intend to sue Miami-Dade County, Miami Beach Police Department, and Carl Rove for having me arrested on phony felony charges. But I very possibly could have gone to prison for something I didn't do, and I hope that your listeners understand that I am one of any number of poster boys and poster girls for what this administration does to truth seekers.
And somewhere in there, you had been getting death threats as well. Can you clarify that for us?
Yeah. What happened there? Well, first of all, the first Bush Nazi article came out on Friday, October 10th in the New Hampshire Gazette. That raises an obvious question. What was the immediate impact of my article and what happened? The article came out on Friday, October 10th. On Sunday, October 12th, the Miami Beach police knocked at my door, including two members of a hostage negotiation team who said they had information in October that I was leading a plot to assassinate Bush. They talked to the editor of the New Hampshire Gazette, saw the paper and the story I had written. They went away. The next day, Monday, October 13th, two Miami Beach detectives knocked on my door. They said they were investigating a report from the Miami Herald that I might be an Al-Qaeda sympathizer who was going to blow up the Miami Herald headquarters. They went away. I had a day off. The next day, they came again and said they had a report I might be a suicide bomber who was going to take out my neighborhood. And 2 days after that, they came again. A SWAT team came and said that they had a report that I was mentally ill and I was planning to commit suicide and take a bunch of other people out with me when I went. So the first week after, or the first 6 days after the first Bush Nazi article came out, the police were at my door with these, you know, mysterious anonymous tips. On Thursday, October 16th, the same day that the fourth police visit arrived at my door, Associated Press got on the Bush Nazi story, and they sent out a story worldwide that night, which is the one that ended up, the abbreviated version that ended up running in newspapers all over the world, but credited me as the reporter. The next night, Friday, October 17th, I was watching the evening news, and about 20, and somebody had posted my address and phone number on the internet that day. And about 20 to 7 that night, Friday, October 17th, the phone rang. I answered the phone, and a voice said, John Buchanan read off my address and said, "You're a traitor to the country. You're a dead man in less than 10 minutes." I completely panicked. I called 911. 911 put me on hold. I hung up. Call back a friend of mine who's the president of the South Beach Hotel Association in Miami Beach. He told me to get out of my apartment. I went across the street to a hotel. My friend called 911. A SWAT team showed up again at my apartment, this time to protect me, and they put me under police watch for that weekend. And so every couple of hours, police came to my door to make sure that I was okay, because they had looked at some emails I had gotten, and they considered them credible death threats. To this day, nobody has properly investigated the source of those original anonymous tips and false police reports, nor has anyone properly investigated who it was who made the phone call threatening my life on the night of October 17th. And on October 20th, I went and visited with the Miami Beach Police Department and asked for an investigation of who it was filing these false reports against me and making the threat against me. And the Miami Beach Police Department would offer no help whatsoever in even launching an investigation.
And do you have the impression that they're not helping you out is due to the fact that of the politics going on there in Miami and in Florida?
Absolutely. I had been a reporter in Miami for 7 years, and I wrote a lot for a newspaper called Miami Today for a couple of years about the fact that, you know, Miami-Dade County is arguably the most corrupt county in the United States, famously so. Also, the state attorney's office in Miami-Dade County is extremely corrupt and well known to be so. The Miami Beach Police Department, which I had written about extensively, is also notoriously corrupt and well known to be so. And I guess I was pretty naive to think that, you know, in the situation I was in, calling the incumbent president of the United States a liar and a mass murderer and a war criminal, that I could expect very friendly treatment from his brother, Jeb, the governor of Florida.
So jumping back to your book, which you've been putting together over this same period of time after the articles, you are doing a tour. How has the audience been for your tour? How have they been receptive to the message you've been bringing?
They've been tremendously receptive, and I want to make it perfectly clear what it is that I'm trying to do, and hope that many people from Greater Seattle will come out over the course of the day today for these three events to hear me speak. Because of certain explosive stuff in my book, specifically having to do with the extent of the lying and deceit of this entire administration over the run-up to the war in Iraq, and the sinister influence of the extreme religious right, a little-known faction called the Dominionist Movement, and a very draconian new piece of legislation that they're trying to waltz through the Congress called the Constitution Restoration Act, that Republicans and Christian voters have to be held responsible by we the people over the next 2.5 weeks, and confronted directly over the fact that once they, as honorable Republicans and sincere Christians, understand what I present in my book and that I have documentary evidence of what I'm talking about, that they cannot vote for George W. Bush on November 2nd, and by using the same information to give those who are lukewarm as Democrats or independents about electing John Curry, which I have reservations about myself, a powerful, powerful motive to work hard for these next 2.5 weeks to get rid of George W. Bush.
Talk briefly about the Constitution Restoration Act.
The Constitution Restoration Act is a piece of legislation currently working its way through both the House and the Senate with no publicity in the mainstream media whatsoever. It was sponsored by extreme right-wing Republicans. The lead sponsors are Robert Atterholt in the House of Alabama and Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama. The Constitution Restoration Act says that the sovereign law of God shall supersede the civil law of the land, and that any sitting Supreme Court justice or federal judge who fails to acknowledge the sovereignty of the law of God shall be impeached and removed from office. In their own literature and as a matter of public record, in speeches, the key leaders of the Dominionist movement say in plain sight that they will ultimately use the Constitution Restoration Act to imprison homosexuals, women who get abortions, and doctors who perform abortions. It is a terrifying, terrifying piece of legislation, and because the media has been silent about it, the average American has absolutely no clue that it even exists. And I spoke 2 weeks ago with the offices of Representative Atterholt and Senator Shelby, and was assured by both offices that they are, quote, very confident this bill will become law. If this bill becomes law, we're headed back to the Spanish Inquisition or worse.
And do you have the impression that this is something that they're going to try and push through by the end of the year? Are they waiting for new administration?
They're going to try to push it through, according to Richard Shelby's press secretary, by the end of this legislative session. She did admit that it's a crowded legislative agenda, but because of Senator Shelby's influence and the fact that he just testified a couple of months ago about it in open hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee, that he has every intention of trying to push the bill through in this legislative session. That's correct.
All right. Just a couple minutes left. We are talking, for those of you just tuning in, with John Buchanan. He is author of the new book, Fixing America, Breaking the Stranglehold on Corporate Rule, Big Media, and the Religious Right. And again, your website is
www.fixingamerica.org. And if I could say one last thing quickly, Mike, I believe that this election on November 2nd is the most important presidential election in U.S. history. And I would ask your listeners what I ask audiences every night, which is please, please, please do everything in your power to rally the vote for John Curry on November 2nd and unelect George W. Bush. And then after November 2nd, we'll worry about properly educating John Curry to what the people of this country really care about and expect from him. But I fear that if George W. Bush is reelected, everything this country has ever stood for will be flushed down the toilet, and I don't want to see that happen.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you very much, Mike.